If you have your Bibles, please open them to the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 1. We will take a momentary break today from the book of Ecclesiastes, and as we do every year, we will recognize the Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, which is today, of course. Monday, I think, is the official date, but we recognize that this is 45 years today or tomorrow from the Roe versus Wade anniversary, 45 years ago that the Supreme Court decided to read into the Constitution the right to an abortion. And while you're turning and finding Jeremiah this morning, I would just ask you this question: where is the deadliest place in America? Where is the deadliest place in America? Many of you would probably say Chicago, right? I mean, we have the news, we see the reports of the homicides, and no doubt Chicago can be a violent place and definitely a deadly city. Last year, Chicago reported 664 murders, and that is actually a down year for them. Chicago is a city that actually claims 39,000 homicides in the last 60 years, an average of 650 homicides per year. Maybe the deadliest place in America isn't a city. Perhaps the deadliest place in America is behind the wheel. In 2017, there were 40,200 deaths by automobile. But still not even close to being the deadliest place in America. How about what we just saw in the video, a video I know you've seen before, but I think really is powerful and sums up this idea so well. How many Americans killed in combat in every American war, going back to the Revolutionary War? Now, I'm saying killed in combat. This isn't necessarily everyone that died during wartime. 651,000 American soldiers killed in combat in every American war. We think about those numbers and we understand that none of these would qualify them for the deadliest place in America. The deadliest place in America is in the womb of a mother. Without a doubt, if we look at the numbers, this is to be true. The Guttmacher Institute on average says there are roughly 1.2 million abortions in the United States each year. That means approximately 3,300 babies are killed each day. And if you took that and divided that by a 24-hour day, we would be looking at 138 babies per hour killed. So in the time that we sit in a service like this today across America, 138 lives will be taken. We are now approaching, by best estimates, between 57 and 58 million lives taken since 1973. Think about that. We're approaching 60 million babies taken. It is truly a holocaust, and I don't use that word lightly, but it is a holocaust, and only that, it's done under the guise of being legal. I believe it is the single greatest moral issue facing us today in our culture. I believe abortion is a violent, anti-God act because it's not only the murder of an innocent whole human being, but we know that it's an affront to the Creator. It's an affront to the God who created each one of those individuals in His image and His likeness. It is the ultimate decline in our culture. It's the ultimate evidence of the wretchedness of our culture. It's the ultimate proof of how deep our atheism runs, that we would kill a life that God created. With that, please stand with me. We're going to read Jeremiah chapter 1. Verses 1 through 5. Jeremiah 1, starting in verse 1. This is the word of the Lord. The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anathoth in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the day of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign. It came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, until the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the exile of Jerusalem in the 5th month. Now the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I have appointed you a prophet to the nations. Thank you. You may be seated. Now, before we go too much further, just a little bit of context. I don't want to take the book of Jeremiah and rip it out of its context in order to meet what I'm trying to do here this morning or communicate this morning. Jeremiah was a prophet of God. He was a prophet of God to Israel's southern kingdom. If you think about our study in Ecclesiastes and think about Solomon, we know from 1 Kings chapter 11 that the kingdom will be ripped out of the hands of Solomon under his son Rehoboam. We've read that, we've studied that. So Solomon is really the last king to rule over a united Israel. From there, Israel is split into two tribes. 10 tribes go north. Those 10 tribes retain the name of Israel. And then, of course, we have the southern tribes, two tribes known as Judah, made up of Judah and Benjamin. And, of course, Judah the greater of these two tribes to the south. And, of course, these two tribes will be the bloodline of David and ultimately of the Messiah. Jeremiah was a contemporary of Josiah. If you've done a study of the kings, you'll find out very quickly that there were many wicked kings and not very many kings that were actually good kings. And Josiah was actually a good one, and Jeremiah lived and was a prophet during many of the years of Josiah's reign. Josiah was probably a few years older than Jeremiah, but we know that they were contemporaries with one another. And we learn more about Josiah in the book of 2 Kings. We're told that not only was he a good king, that he was the best of the kings. If you go to 2 Kings chapter 23, if you want to flip back there for just a moment. Starting in verse 24. Second Kings 23, starting in verse 24. This tells us some of what Josiah had done. Moreover, Josiah removed the mediums and the spiritists and the teraphim and the idols and all the abominations that were seen in the land of Judah and Jerusalem, that he might confirm the words of the law which were written in the book of Hilkiah the priest, found in the house of the Lord. Before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart and all his soul and with all his might according to all of the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after. Those would be pretty good words to have spoken of you, wouldn't it? There was none like him before, there was none like him after. He was a great king, and he was born in the time of a wicked nation, and we know that much of that wickedness centered around idolatry. We see that in Judah that the kings were following the gods of the Canaanites. They were raising up Asherim poles and they were worshiping the Baals and doing all the things that the pagans around them were doing. And Josiah comes on the scene. He actually takes over as king when he is 8 years old. And right around the time he would have been 16 years old, we find out that there must have been some sort of conversion that took place, some kind of life change that took place in the life of Josiah, because we see that roughly 4 years after the age of 16, he begins to take down all these false gods and get rid and purge the land of all the idolatry that we see in the land. However, though, what we do recognize is that one king, one good king, amidst all the bad kings, and if you know your study of Kings, we know that he follows Manasseh, who's considered one of the most wicked kings. There's Manasseh and then Amon, and then we see Josiah come on the scene, and you understand that one good king isn't enough to sway the people. As a matter of fact, we don't really know that the hearts of the people changed under Josiah, except they were just following his lead and really doing what he had done, because he was a young leader and a charismatic guy, I'm guessing, somebody that was bold enough to do the things that he had done. But the people, we know, would return to their abominations before the Lord. And this is the time in which Jeremiah the prophet lived, and he was a prophet to this southern kingdom of Judah. Now, before we get into the people's return in the book of Jeremiah, and we will spend most of our time in the book of Jeremiah today, kind of moving around a little bit, I want to talk about, first of all, what is it in the womb? I believe to understand some of the ideas and some of the concepts that we're going to go through this morning, we need to understand rightly what is in the mother's womb. And you say, well, that's very basic. It's a baby. Of course it's a baby. We know that, right? But that's not a given today in our culture. As a matter of fact, we understand rightly that many people believe, especially if they are on the side of choice per se, that's just a clump of cells, that it's not really a living, breathing human being. But I believe the whole argument for abortion centers on what is it in the woman's womb. Every time we say it's a choice, we need to ask, well, what is it that we are trying to kill? Is that an innocent, whole human being, or are we in fact talking about just a clump of cells? That makes a difference, right? If you look in verses 4 and 5, I believe in Jeremiah chapter 1, we begin to get at this point of what it is in the womb. Jeremiah writes, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you." This gives us the idea that God is active in the creation process. God is not afar off while we are being fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, if we consider this strictly from a scientific standpoint, we know many times Christians, we're called the science denier people, right? We're the flat earthers. We're the people that believe in this book that we shouldn't believe in. But from a scientific viewpoint, it is a medical fact that life begins at conception. It's a fact. It's undeniable. The science of embryology tells us this, that from the moment the 23 paternally derived chromosomes are fertilized with the 23 maternal chromosomes, we know that all the DNA, all the material that is there is needed at conception. This new life has its own blood, its own DNA, its own brain, its own liver, meaning that the baby that is inside the mother is not, in fact, part of the mother's body. It's its own body within the mother's body. So that argument that we hear quite frequently, my body, my choice, well, no, it is not your body and it is not your choice. This is a completely separate, innocent, whole human being made in the image of God, and murder should never be a choice. But let's move beyond the scientific, because that's not my area of expertise. I want to look for a moment at what the Bible says. And we see in verse 5 very clearly, God is not removed from this process. God says to Jeremiah, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you." David understood this very well. If you flip back to the Psalms, go back to Psalm 139. Starting in verse 13. To see, we're not just using Jeremiah for our example. Psalm 139, starting in verse 13. Listen to what David says. "For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth," by the way, which is a picture of the womb. "Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them." David makes it very clear that God is involved. He gives the idea and that illustration of somebody being knit together. And I know some of you ladies knit, and I don't think you guys do, but I know some of you ladies knit, and I know that there's patterns and colors, and there's a plan that goes into place when you knit something. And this is saying that God has a pattern and plan in place for each creation. We don't come here by mere chance. Verse 14 says, "For I am fearfully and wonderfully made. It is God who made us and not we ourselves." And I don't know if you've ever heard a couple say this before. A lot of times you'll hear a couple say, "Well, you know, we made a baby." You ever heard that statement, by the way? "We made a baby." No, you didn't make a baby. You are the human instrumentation through which God made a baby. Let me tell you something. All we do is we transmit the physical features, but you cannot make a soul. Are you guys tracking with me? We cannot make a soul. Psalm 104, verse 30, the psalmist writes this, "You send forth your spirit and they are created." You cannot, through a physical relationship, create an immortal, eternal soul in creation as God does. So this reminds me of what the Apostle Paul says in Galatians chapter 1, verse 15. Paul says this, "But when God, who had set me apart even from my mother's womb and called me through His grace," Paul knew, David knew, Jeremiah knew, and as Christians, we need to know that God has His hand and He's active in the creation process. Why does that matter? Because when we see that we are made in the image and likeness of God, we understand rightly that every single human life matters. Abortion then, with that mindset, becomes a violent anti-God act. It's an affront to the Creator who creates. When we have an abortion, when we see an abortion take place, that is the killing of an image bearer. We are killing the image and the likeness of God. We're killing the innocent. Which takes us to our second point in your notes, if you're looking at the back of your bulletins today, the blood of the innocent. The blood of the innocent. And before you turn to Jeremiah chapter 19, I want you to flip over to Jeremiah chapter 2 for just a moment, verse 34. On our way to Jeremiah chapter 19. Jeremiah 2 verse 34 says this, "Also on your skirts is found the lifeblood of the innocent poor. You did not find them breaking in, but in spite of all these things." If you see there, that says their skirts were stained by the lifeblood of the innocent poor. This is a horrible indictment on the women of the nation. That phrase, innocent blood, occurs about 20 times in the Bible. And the context we see here is always one of condemning those who shed innocent blood. It's a warning against those who would share innocent blood. And here, Jeremiah puts it in the context of widows, orphans, and the poor. Innocent blood includes the blood of children. And this does not mean children have no sin, right? All the parents said amen. If you have children, you know that you've got little sinners. It doesn't take you long to realize that. But what innocent means is, in relationship to society and to other people, these have done no crime against society that's worthy of capital punishment. It's not worthy of death. He is innocent in that sense. And in that sense, all infants of all time are always innocent. Now we know that the Lord God can take a life, even an infant life, at any time that He wants. Job 1:21 says, "The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." But humans must not take the life of an innocent infant. God has forbidden us from taking innocent life. The sixth commandment, you shall not, what? Murder. I've been in conversations, debates, whatever you want to call them, with people who, of course, come from the choice side, and they're like, "What biblical evidence do you have? The word abortion is not in the Bible." And I look at them simply and say, "Thou shalt not kill." But that gets back to the first point that we looked at. What is it in the mother's womb? If that is, in fact, an innocent, whole human being, and we rightly understand that, then we understand that every time an abortion takes place, that that innocent, whole human being is being what? It's being murdered. It means to take innocent life. Flip to Jeremiah 19 now. Verses 4 and 5. By the way, Jeremiah was called the weeping prophet. He had his prophecies were probably some of the unfriendliest and worst received prophecies of all time. And we'll see why here in just a moment. Jeremiah 19, verse 4. God says, because they have forsaken me and have made this an alien place and have burned sacrifices in it to other gods that neither they nor their forefathers nor the kings of Judah had ever known. And because they have filled this place with the blood of the what? Of the innocent, and have built the high places of Baal to burn their sons in the fire as burnt offerings to Baal, a thing which I never commanded or spoke of, nor did it ever enter into my mind. Keep that thought for a moment, because we're going to see that idea coming back again and again, that it never even entered in the mind of God that they would burn their own innocent children and make them pass through the fire. So what is God saying here? In essence, God is saying you changed gods, and when you changed gods, you left the God of life, you left the Creator God and went to the God of death. And now this is part of your culture, it's part of your environment, and you're putting your offspring to death in worship. Think about that. In worship. You're putting the children to death that God has given you as a heritage from the Lord. Psalm 127:3, it's on the front of your bulletins. They're taking innocent life. Look back to chapter 7 of Jeremiah. Chapter 7, verse 30. For the sons of Judah have done that which is evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house which is called by my name to defile it. They've defiled their place of worship. Furthermore, in verse 31, they have built high places of Torpeth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire which I did not command, and it did not what? Come into my mind. God had forbidden this practice. Well, he'd forbidden the practice of following false gods, but forbidden the practice, and yet the Israelites still offered their babies as sacrifices in the high places. They offered them in the fire to the god, small g, of Molech, under some sort of delusion that God is going to bless them for this worship that they're putting out. Go to Jeremiah 32 now. I know this is a bit of a Bible study this morning. Jeremiah 32, verse 34. But they put their detestable things in the house which is called my name to defile it. They built the high places of Baal that are in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to cause their sons and their daughters, again there's that phrase, to pass through the fire to Molech, which I had not commanded them, nor had it entered into my mind that they should do this. Now we see another description, abomination to cause Judah to sin. This is now labeled an abomination. This is a very stench before the nostrils of God. And there's no question what he's talking about when he uses that term innocent blood. He is talking about the babies. He is talking about the children that had to pass through the fire to the god of Molech. And these children had done no crime worthy of death. They're not worthy of punishment, especially capital punishment. And their worship is a part of false gods. So they're basically offering their children up as sacrifices for nothing. Again, the children that are called a heritage from the Lord, a blessing from the Lord. Turn back to the Psalms again, to 106. Thankfully, all these books are close together, right? Go back to the Psalms, to 106, starting in verse 35. Just in case you think this isn't something going on with Jeremiah. But they mingled with the nations and learned their practices. Now remember that God chose Israel as a set-apart people to be different from those around them, to be a light to the pagans. But it says they mingled with the nations instead and learned their practices and served their idols, which became a snare to them. It became a trap. They even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons. You talk about getting down to the point. We don't name it by the false god. Here we see named for what it is. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons and shed innocent blood. The sons of their daughters, or their sons and their daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with the blood. Thus they became unclean in their practices, and they played the harlot in their deeds. That is what they're speaking of here in Jeremiah. The land was polluted with blood, this blood of the innocent, innocent blood. And today in America, we know that the land here has been polluted by 58 million babies killed in America since Roe versus Wade in 1973. It wasn't merely a killing because the king allowed it or made it legal. It wasn't merely that the religious leaders had failed and started to practice the same very thing, but it's the fact that the fathers and the mothers, the one who were put on earth to protect the most innocent of life, their own children, they were taking their children and putting them to death. They were literally burning them alive. And that is the imagery we have in Jeremiah, the lifeblood of the innocent on the skirts of the women. And here in America, I would say that we have something similar killing going on here in this nation. And you say, well, Pastor Steve, come on, that's an exaggeration. I mean, we're not burning children alive. Have you ever seen an abortion performed before? A chemical abortion? Can I share with you a clear sign to me that a nation has departed from the one true God, a sign that a nation has departed from the God of the Bible, is the shedding of innocent blood. When a nation gets to the point that we are so blind, that we are so reprobate, that we do not call out murder for what it is, that we can turn a blind eye to 58 million of the God's innocent taken, sanctioned by government, celebrated by the culture in the name of the freedom to choose, I believe that nation should be very afraid. Look at every great nation. If you think back to last week, I told you the Roman Empire, they legislated abortion and infanticide. They legislated it. And look at every great empire that has ever done that, and look at what's happened to that empire. It falls. You know, it's painful to think of this in time, and it even hurts to say it, but America is not a Christian nation. We certainly have a nation with a lot of Christians living within the borders, but we are not, in fact, a Christian nation. A Christian nation does not turn a blind eye to 58 million deaths of innocents. As a matter of fact, according to the UN, the United States is one of seven nations in the world that allows abortions after 20 weeks. You want to know who the other nations are that we're married to with this statistic? America, China, North Korea, Vietnam, Canada, the Netherlands. Anybody seen the Netherlands in the news in this last year, by any chance? They were in the news because they said openly that they would eradicate Down syndrome in their nation. Was that Norway? I'm sorry. You know how they go about eradicating Down syndrome in their nation? It's through abortion. It's by taking a segment of people and putting a circle around that segment of people and saying that this group is not worthy of life. And we have seen how that works out in society, haven't we? World wars are fought over things of this nature. When the Germans put a circle around the Jews and say, this segment of the population is not worthy of life. But now all of a sudden, it's okay because they're in the womb and we really can't see what's going on. And my question is, if it's okay to kill the baby in the womb, then why is it not okay to kill an 18-year-old? Micah's going, I'm glad I'm 17. or a 14-year-old, or a 10-year-old, or a 2-year-old, because the point is they're all in different stages of development. And if we're just gonna have them killed because they're not in the stage of development that we prefer, because we don't understand rightly that the 6 to 8 inch trip down the birth canal does not somehow give life to someone, then we are completely lost and upside down as a nation. And I think if you find yourself in a place where your nearest compatriots are China and North Korea, that says a lot about your nation. I would point out that today and tomorrow, as we lament the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, there are many more people that will be celebrating this anniversary. There are many more people that are having parties and celebrating this day on the calendar. America is caught up in idolatry. We are no different than Judah or Israel. We're no different than they are. And you can say, well, Pastor Steve, we're not that primitive. You know, we're not making our kids pass through the fire. We're not worshiping these primitive gods that they worship like Moloch. But yes, we are. The vehicle may be different. The vehicle that we use to get there may look different. But the idolatry is the very same as the idolatry that you see in Judah. The God we worship today in America is what? What's our God today, if we're honest? Self. It's selfism. It's me on the throne. And that is idolatry. That is us making a God in our image, in our likeness. And it says that, well, I'm going to do the things the way I want to do them, and nobody's going to tell me how to do them. That's the whole thing behind that mantra that we hear, right? My body, my choice. And you know, there's many in the abortion movement that are honest enough to say, you know what, I'll give you the fact that we are killing babies without blinking an eye. But what they would tell you is that choice of the mother is more important than killing a baby. And that is idolatry. That is what that is, plain and simple. It's breaking the first commandment. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other what? God's before me. And what it comes down to many times is, I don't want to be inconvenienced with a child. I can't do this right now. I can't afford a baby. As we drool over the next iPhone. The God of self, the God of convenience, the God of wealth. I can't have a baby right now because that knocks me off the corporate ladder, and I'm not going to be up for promotion. I'm not going to be able to make more money if I have another baby. And we're chasing after false gods, not the God of the Bible, who will judge those who shed innocent blood, as he judged Judah. We're chasing after the God of self. Proverbs 6:16 says this, there are 6 things that the Lord hates, yea, 7 that are an abomination to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run to evil, those who cause dissension among the brethren. But we see that God hates those who shed innocent blood. And if we think that somehow God is going to judge Judah and just give us a pass, I think we are confused. God is not changing, and he is not asleep. And if we study the book of Jeremiah rightly, we understand that Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet because he tells the people of the land that ultimately they will be judged by the Babylonians, who will take Jerusalem and take them away into captivity. In the meantime, in America, pastors are silent in their pulpits. They don't preach messages like this because it's not something that's going to make you skip out to the parking lot. Politicians give lip service at best, and I don't care which party you're talking about. One side openly tells us that they're for abortion. The other side tells us they're against it and does very little to show that. What's your grounds for saying that? Well, we've had 45 years. And Roe v. Wade still where it was before. And $550 million of taxpayer money is still going to Planned Parenthood, the world's nation's largest abortion provider. cannot continue to shed innocent blood. The last point there is we cannot claim ignorance. Proverbs 24, if you'd look there. Proverbs 24, verse 11. Deliver those who are being taken away to death and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. If you say, we did not know this, does he not consider it who weighs the hearts? And does he not know it who keeps your soul? And will not a man render according to his work? We cannot be guilty of this. We cannot say we didn't know. We cannot say, I didn't realize that things were that bad. We've got 45 years, 58 million. And the Lord who said deliver, meaning to rescue those who are being taken away to death, God is not going to excuse. He says, behold, we did not know this. That's not going to be an excuse because God, according to the text, says he considers the heart of the one he says that he knows your soul. He knows very good and well if you knew about this and you were complicit in it by your silence. Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday just passed, and we remember because of his relentless truth-telling in the face of established, legalized racial evil, once said this, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetrate it." The killing of children can be tolerated and even championed as a social good, so long as we don't call it what it is. Think about it. We have all of these words because the other side tries to control the conversation. We call abortion abortion because abortion sounds a lot neater than saying we killed 58 million babies. Even the very word fetus. Why do we use the language and allow the other side to use that language and then we use it ourselves, don't we? And we understand that those who control the conversation many times control the argument, right? I mean, fetus is nothing more than a Latin term. Oh, by the way, didn't the Reformers struggle to get the Bible in the English language and out of Latin so the people could understand it? And yet we still use that terminology. Call an abortion an individual's right to privacy, and you can write it into legal code. Call an abortion a compassionate choice offered to a frightened girl to save her future or save a child from an undesirable quality of life, and you can swing popular opinion for almost anything. Call an abortion a liberation of women from the social and economic oppression of the male dominance, and passionate people will march on the Capitol demanding to preserve the rights of abortion on demand as if somehow you can find that in the Constitution, which you cannot. Not only that, it flies in the face of the 14th Amendment. We have allowed legal child killing on demand for 45 years because we've called it something other than what it is. But you won't hear people in the street chant, "We will fight for the right to kill our children." Have you ever heard that at a pro-choice rally? Why do you think it's called choice? Because calling abortion what it is might awaken uneasy consciences out of a euphoric sleep or a stupor to realize that millions of defenseless human beings right now on this planet are being denied the self-evident truth that we claim. We hold these truths to be what? Self-evident. What does that mean? It means it shouldn't need explanation, right? It's like when I see one of my teenage kids and they're looking at me like they're confused and I'm like, you should know this. It should be evident. How much more so this? And what is the very first thing that we know? We know that the person is entitled to what? To life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you cut off life, then everything else falls by the wayside. The Creator endowed human right to life. It doesn't come from man. It comes from God. And so we must keep speaking. We must call abortion what it is, the killing of innocent, whole human beings, a vicious, established, legal evil and injustice. Jeremiah was called the weeping prophet because his messages were not popular with the people. You can imagine standing up in front of a bunch of idolaters and telling them they're idolatrous, and oh, by the way, you need to quit making your sons and daughters pass through the fire. But I would ask you today, if you were alive in Judah in the time of Jeremiah, would you find yourself on the side of Jeremiah, or would you find yourself on the side of God, or on the side of the people of the land who were anti-God? He tried to warn the people. We have been warned, and we cannot claim ignorance any longer. And as I do with these messages, I'd just like to impress upon you, so what do we do? Right? What is the do points of this thing? I believe, first of all, that we are a people that understand adoption, or should understand adoption, better than anyone else in this world. Right? Because we've been adopted into the family of God if we're Christians today. And I think adoption is a beautiful thing, and that we have folks here that have adopted. We have foster parents. We have respite foster parents here in the church, and I believe that's a great place to start. I know Rita would champion that idea very well, and I'm not going to steal any of your thunder, but I know how you feel about adoption. We should be the adoption people. Encourage pastors in the area, if you know them, to speak out. It's very easy for us to immediately go to and point the finger at the politicians, but the fact is that even in the church, women that name the name of Christ and are evangelicals are still going and having abortions. And to me, that just says that there's silence in the church on this matter, and there shouldn't be silence. We got to be able to speak on truth. We cannot hide from the truth because we're afraid it's political and it might upset some people. So we adopt, we foster, pray for your pastor, pray for the pastors, speak to them. And I would also encourage you, yes, there's nothing wrong with getting involved in the political process, but do not look for that to be your change. And matter of fact, I would encourage you more to pray for your politicians than anything else, because that's the only thing that's ultimately going to change their hearts. If they are lost and they are anti-God, they are not going to see this. You can preach pro-life until you're blue in the face, and it's not going to register. Pray for them. And finally, I've got it in here that we support the Pregnancy Center of Central Iowa. We have been blessed, I believe, in our area to have right here in Newton a center that comes alongside women who are facing unexpected pregnancies. You know, the argument that we constantly hear from folks is, well, you Christians, you care about the baby in the womb, but you don't care about the baby after the baby is born, right? You've ever heard that argument before? Well, I would say the Pregnancy Center definitely flies in the face of that argument with the services provided, both through counseling, through different things that are available there in-house. And I'm going to let Rita speak on that more in a moment. But before she does, we've done this the last couple years, and I would just encourage you, if you look right outside the window of the sanctuary there, you can see there's a bunch of baby bottles lined up. Everybody's got change at home. I know you do. You either got it in your home, or you got it in your ashtray, or you know, on your floorboards. You got it somewhere. I'm asking you to collect that, fill up a bottle with change. You think that's a little thing, and every year we've done this. We've brought in $700, $1,000. In change. Okay? So if you would, take one of these before you leave. They're right outside the door. Don't take it if you're not going to do something with it. I don't want you to hang it from your ornament, you know, on your rear view for a week. We're going to collect these back in 2 weeks. That's what we typically do. I'm going to give you 2 weeks. If you know someone that'll allow you to put these up in a business or something like that where you can collect change, the more the merrier. It's okay, isn't it, right? Okay. So, with that, I'm going to bring Rita up and allow her to say a few things about the Pregnancy Center. We are blessed to have Rita Baker. She is a wonderful director. She's got a heart for adoption and life, and we are blessed to have her and blessed to be on the board and work with her. So, Mike, is the pulpit mic? Can you?